Okay. So basically, just for some background, so that I can use specifics in these later parts rather than just gene X. So a lot of the stuff that people work with, and particularly the papers that you read, were dealing with repressor proteins. And so there's sort of three main repressors that everybody pretty much works with. So this is LacI, lambda C1, and TET-R. And they have the advantage of these are sort of the best studied of the repressor proteins. So they're well characterized. They're easy to express. We know that they work in bacteria. And so sort of the associated promoter for each one, we have PLAC, PR, and PL, and then PTET. So the TET-R is completely exogenous to the E. coli. So your normal wild-type E. coli is not going to be making any TET-R, which is good. You don't have any crosstalk with the host. The lambda C1, it comes from the lambda phage. So if your host has been infected by lambda and it has a lambda lysogen, then you might have some crosstalk issues that somebody else is producing the lambda repressor. But again, you can get strains of E. coli that haven't been infected by lambda. So that one's pretty clean. LacI, I mean, this is a normal protein in bacteria, but you can get strains, they're pretty common, that have this LacI knocked out. So all three of these, I mean, as long as you pick your strain correctly, there's none of the repressor protein around except the stuff that you add in. The other nice thing is that all of these have sort of knobs that you can use to tune the repression. So for LacI, this is one of the classic ones. You have IPTG. So as you add IPTG, it makes the LAC repressor fall apart. And so you get less repression, more transcription off of PLAC. Similarly for PTET, we have ATC. So this is the tetracycline repressor. ATC is a version of tetracycline that's not physiologically active, but it still makes the TET repressor come apart. And then for lambda C1, we have temperature-sensitive versions of the repressor. So you raise the temperature, and the repressor molecule falls apart. So a lot of the people who started working in this field were electrical engineers. And so they sort of brought the tools of electrical engineering to these problems. And particularly, they like thinking about digital logic and trying to implement the types of digital logic gates that you find in normal electronics. So one of the classic ones here is an inverter. So the idea is that you have some kind of input at A, and it gives you an output at B. So all of our inputs, since this is digital, all of our inputs are 0 or 1. And the idea is that it takes 0 or 1 and gives you the opposite. And in normal electronics, this would be voltages. So if you have a low voltage coming in, you get a high voltage going out, and vice versa. So the idea was, how could we make this implement a similar construct, but using biology rather than using voltages? So the idea was to take these repressor proteins and use them to do this sort of inversion. So a simple construct to do this, we have PTET. Driving the expression of LacI, then so this is sort of my shorthand. This is a promoter, a ribosome binding site, the coding region for some kind of gene, and a transcriptional terminator. So the idea is that we have sort of two modules here, two devices, if you want to call them that, where this one just produces LacI. So in a cell where you haven't put in any TET repressor, the PTET is going to be producing, it's just a constitutive promoter, and it's a pretty strong promoter. So we have PTET driving the expression of LACI. So this just produces some constant amount of LACI. That guy. Now, this thing, this is PLAC. So it takes in LACI. It sort of reads the level of LACI in the cell and produces gene X, whatever this is, in response. So we can draw sort of a transfer curve. If this is the LACI that's going into the device, and this is gene X coming out of the device, then we get some kind of transfer curve. So when you have low levels of LACI around, you're getting a lot of transcription off of this PLAC, so you're making a lot of gene X. And vice versa, if you have high levels of LACI, you repress PLAC, so you make very little of your downstream gene. So, I mean, on the surface, this looks great. We have sort of this same kind of characteristic, that if our input is low, then our output is high. And if our output is high, or if our input is high, our output is low. So it's all well and good, except that if we want to connect multiple inverters in series, so I mean, if I want to take this and connect it to another device, or I want to use a different input, the problem is that what I'm passing back and forth between these devices is proteins. And I mean, again, this seems reasonable. So the nice thing is, I mean, these devices are all a specific piece of, I mean, they're a stretch of DNA self-contained. So I can take this, I mean, this goes from, this device goes from the promoter to the transcription terminator. I can put it in any plasmid anywhere in the cell. Similarly, I mean, it's kind of nice that we're passing proteins around this, because it's pretty easy to measure proteins. I mean, that's a standard biological problem, and we have good ways of doing that. The problem is that, I mean, what if I need to take this inverter? So this inverter takes LACI in and gives me gene X out. What if rather than something producing LACI, I have something that produces TETR? Well, I can't really connect these two devices together because they're passing back and forth different molecules. So either I need sort of a library of different inverters. So I need some inverter that takes TETR, and maybe I need one that takes C1. And similarly, I mean, this, we could just build a whole lot of inverters. Or, I mean, you start thinking about maybe we can find some way to convert between, so you have another device in here that just takes TETR and gives you LACI out. But it gets very complicated very fast. So one solution to this problem is sort of to shift our device boundaries. So rather, I mean, here, our device boundary is we go from sort of the promoter to the terminator. What we can do is shift this so that now our device is there. And so what we've done here is what's moving in and out of our device is rates of transcription. So this just, this promoter here just produces some constant rate of transcription. So if you read the comic book on the website, this is POPs, polymerases per second. So some level of polymerase is coming into this stretch of DNA. So if we have a high level of polymerases coming in, we make a lot of the LACI protein. If you make a lot of the LACI protein, you shut off transcription of PLAC. If we shut off transcription of PLAC, we have very little transcription, very few polymerases coming out of the device. So if we have, this is POPs in versus POPs out. If we have high levels of POPs in, we make a lot of the LAC repressor, so we shut off transcription from PLAC, and we're down here. Similarly, if we have low POPs in, So very little transcription coming into this device. We make very little of the LAC repressor. So we get a lot of transcription off of PLAC, and we have a lot of polymerases, a lot of transcription coming out of our device. So again, we have the same kind of curve that we want, except now what's moving back and forth between devices, the signal carrier in our devices, is this POPs, the rate of transcription. And the advantage here is that the output of the device is in the same units, the same type of currency as what's coming into the device. Now, I mean, there are downsides of this approach as well. That, first of all, these, in order to put two devices together, you have to put them on the same stretch of DNA. So this is a, in POPs terminology, this is a device. It just produces a constant level of POPs. But in order to compose it with this device, which is a POPs inverter, you have to physically put them together on the same piece of DNA, which, I mean, it's not a big deal. We can do that pretty easily with cloning. The other problem is that, I mean, it's great to talk about POPs, but they're very difficult to measure. So whereas measuring protein concentrations is pretty simple, measuring rates of transcription is a lot more complicated. It's something that's very difficult to do directly. You usually have to sort of infer it from measuring sort of rates of protein production, for instance. But it's a convenient way of thinking about putting together these devices. So does that make sense? Any questions? Okay. So as long as I'm talking about, so this is sort of a classic example of a device. So in this parts, devices, systems hierarchy, each of these elements, so the promoter, the ribosome binding site, the coding region, each of those is a part. You put the parts together, you get a device. So this thing here is a inverter. It's a kind of classic example of a device. One other device that I want to introduce, just because it's a pretty useful one and may come up when we're talking about designing our system, is a signaling devices. So this is ways that cells basically talk to each other. So what we've done is taken a natural system. So this is the quorum sensing system from Vibrio Fischeri, and moved it into E. coli. So we have what's called a sender. So again, we're working in the POPs hierarchy here. So the idea is that you have some rate of transcription coming into this device, and what it does is produce LUXI. So it takes POPs in, and gives you out this LUXI protein. And LUXI is an enzyme that will make a small molecule called AHL. That's short for acyl homoserine lactone. So this is a small molecule. It's produced by LUXI. It diffuses into the media, and then the cells can sort of check the level of AHL around. So it's a way to see sort of how many other cells are nearby. So if there are a lot of cells, if all of the cells are making AHL, if you have very few, then the concentration of AHL in the media is going to be pretty low. As the culture density builds up, the amount of AHL also builds up. So then we have a receiver. So the idea of the receiver is that you're producing some constant level of LUXR, because we're using the TETR as just a constitutive promoter, or sorry, PTET. We're using PTET as just a constitutive promoter to drive expression of LUXR. So you're making some constant level of LUXR. LUXR is a transcription factor that binds to AHL. And when it binds to AHL, it becomes active, and it'll activate this PLUX-R. So the idea is that you take in this AHL molecule, and you give out POPs. So we have LuxR around. If there's enough AHL around to activate LuxR, then we get transcription out of here. If there's no AHL around, you get no transcription, so no POPs out. And the important thing here, though, is you're responding to AHL, but AHL can freely diffuse in and out of the cells. So you're responding to the total amount of AHL in the media rather than just to the amount of AHL that you yourself have made. So it's an easy way for cells to sort of communicate one state, whether they're on or off, something about themselves. And this brings up an important issue of crosstalk between devices. So when we draw these devices, we like to think of them as just, I mean, a box. So I need an inverter, I go grab an inverter, I put it into wherever I need it. The problem is that it's a relatively small list of well-characterized components that we can use. So there are relatively few parts that just keep getting reused over and over again. So PTET, for instance, I mean, we like to use it as a constitutive promoter, because as long as you aren't trying to use TET-R in your system, it's great. It's strong, it's constitutive, it's easy, you just drop it in and go. The problem is, if, for instance, we wanted to use this receiver along with an inverter that used TET-R, then we'd have problems, because we've got this thing crosstalking with our inverter, because the inverter is producing some level of TET-R, so we're modulating our expression of LuxR. And again, I mean, it's one more thing to add to the list of issues that you have to consider when you're designing your system. And hopefully this will become less of an issue as we get more better parts. But right now it's still a problem. So on the level of parts and devices, any questions?
Well, I had a question about what does AHL do to the receiver system?
OK. So it binds to LuxR, and if I remember right, it induces LuxR to dimerize, and then it's the LuxR dimer that's active as a transcription factor. So we have the LuxR monomer just floating around. That's what this PTET portion is doing. And then if there's AHL in the media, LuxR dimerizes and activates PLuxR. If there's no AHL around, it just stays as a monomer and it's not transcriptionally active. Okay, so moving on to talking about systems now. So this is getting into the papers that you had read earlier. So one of the really simple systems is this toggle switch. So we have this inverter that takes A to B. And so again, we go back to our simple digital description of it, except now we want to add another inverter and connect this thing back around. And it actually still works out, because so if the amount of A is low, then B is going to be high, but we invert it again. So now we've got a low amount coming out of our second inverter, and the system is stable. So there's two states where it can be stable. Either you have A high, which is both the input to the first inverter and the output of the second inverter, or you have A low. So our simple digital description of this system works fine. And the physical implementation uh, didn't actually write down. So the physical implementation is just that you have two repressor proteins where each protein represses the synthesis of the other one. So biologically, what these states represent is whether we have that repressor protein around. So if we have a lot of A around, then we repress the synthesis of B, so there's no repression of the promoter for A. So again, we get high levels of A. And this is important because it gives you sort of a memory in the system of the cell remembers whether it's in the low state or the high state, and we can switch it back and forth between those two states. So, for instance, unfortunately just erased it. So for all of these repressors, we have this sort of knob that we can tune of changing the repression, so adding IPTG or ATC or changing the temperature. So we can sort of interfere with either of those kinds of repression and sort of push the cell one direction or another. Or you could imagine having some other system, some other device that produces one of these repressors, and that could kick the system into a different state. So specifically, like you said, the system that they were working with was pretty simple. They were just looking at fluorescence. So what they did was they actually attached GFP to this so that they could look at GFP as the output of their cell. They actually, later papers, they took this same toggle switch and did some more interesting things with it. So for instance, they, rather than just producing GFP, they had it trigger biofilm formation, or there are a couple others, I forget the details now. So I don't know how much you paid attention to sort of where they were experimentally characterizing this system, but what they decided to do was use flow cytometry to characterize it. And the nice thing about this system is that it's stable. So you put it into one of the states, and it'll stay there until you pull it out. So you have a fair amount of time to take samples that you know are in the specific state that you care about, and then you can analyze those on your own time. So what they did was flow cytometry, where you basically send single cells through the machine one at a time and look at the fluorescence of each cell individually. So you get this, it's normally for one color, it's displayed as a histogram where you have number of cells versus the fluorescence of each cell. And so what they showed was that the low state, you get some kind of distribution at relatively low fluorescence. And when you push it into the second higher state, the cells produce more fluorescence. So, I mean, this is a really nice way to do measurements because you get information on the single cells. So, I mean, one of the classic things to worry about is if you see, so a lot of measurements that people take are sort of the bulk population average of something. So when you're looking at, for instance, a Western blot, you're looking at the population average of the protein production. The problem is that if your population average shifts, there's two ways that that could happen. Either you're shifting from here to there, or you're shifting from this to so it could be that it's a shift in the mean of the population, that the entire population is shifting, or it could be that you have sort of two subpopulations, one at low fluorescence, one at low expression, one at high expression, and you're shifting back and forth between the two. And it's pretty much impossible to distinguish between these two using sort of bulk measurements. So protein production, mRNA production, that kind of thing. But in flow cytometry, the advantage is that you're looking at individual cells. So you can pretty easily distinguish between these two options. The downside is, I mean, it takes a while to collect your sample, run your sample. You're looking at different cells every time you... Every measurement you run is a different sample of cells. So, I mean, you take your sample at time zero, you run that. You take a different sample with different cells at 10 minutes later, and you run that. But again, this was a reasonably simple system, so it worked pretty well. Any questions about toggle switch? So making this slightly more complicated, we go to the repressolator. And for whatever reason, Michael Elowitz is a big fan of names. So this is his oscillator, and he called it the repressolator for reasons that, I mean, it's an oscillator using repressor proteins, but... So the idea is that you take this toggle switch and you basically add one more inverter to the series. And so now if A is low, then we go through one inversion, B is high. So another inversion, C is low. Final inversion, A is high. The system's clearly not going to reach a steady state. So the better way of thinking about this, I mean, the digital picture doesn't really, the truth table doesn't really work anymore because it's not going to stabilize. So if A is high, B is low, which means C is rising, so A is falling, and you can sort of continue around in this system. So the specific version that Michael used was he had tetR repressing lambda C1, which was repressing LacI, which was repressing tetR. So these are the three inverters that he was working with. And there are a couple sort of subtleties here that... So first of all, I don't know if you noticed this from the paper, but all three of these were what he called light. So it's tetR light, LacI light, and C1 light. So as Christina explained last time, this is a protein degradation tag that's been added to the molecules. So it's telling the cellular machinery that they should degrade this repressor protein as fast as they can. And I believe Michael actually used a pretty strong degradation tag here. So you lower the half-life of the molecule, and that's actually really important for this oscillator working, because what's oscillating is the level of protein in the cell. So you can only increase the level of protein as fast as your transcription and translation works, and you can only, eventually the cycle needs to shut off, so you can only decrease the protein as fast as the protein machinery can degrade it, or as fast as it dilutes out by the cell dividing. So the idea is that you get sort of these pulses of tetR and then LacI and C1 and then another. So this is sort of the ideal picture of you get a pulse of tetR and then a pulse of LacI and then a pulse of C1, and you tie one of these proteins into GFP. So we take, I forget which protein it was, or which promoter it was, but you can take, for instance, PLAC, and have it driving GFP so that when LacI levels are low, so basically in there, you get GFP, or vice versa. So Michael built this system. Took him as I understand it, a couple of years worth of tweaking to get all of the rate constants just right. So we had to play around with the half-lives of the molecules and the strength of the promoter and so on and so forth. Now, going back to this question of flow cytometry with the toggle switch, flow cytometry wouldn't work very well in this case because it's a dynamic system. So the problem is, I mean, there's some delay between when you take your sample and when you can run it out on flow cytometry. And the worry here is that they're going to change state in that time period. So the way Michael measured these is he used time-lapse microscopy. So he plated the cells on agar and took pictures every couple of minutes. So the other nice thing about microscopy is that you can follow the same cell. So you pick one spot that you're looking in on that agar plate, and so you take a picture of the cell at time zero, you take a picture of the exact same cell at 5 minutes later, 10 minutes later, and so forth. Which brings us to one of the problems of this oscillator, which is it doesn't stay synchronized very long. So if you have a population of cells, so we have one cell dividing, going to two cells. So each of these cells, I mean, this cell is oscillating at some period. Once it divides, these guys can oscillate at different periods. I mean, they have their own set of all of these repressor proteins. And there's nothing really constraining the time scale of this oscillation. So the oscillation normally happens on like roughly a 50-minute time scale. So from this peak in tet R to the next peak in tet R is round numbers about 50 minutes, which is pretty slow. I mean, we can't get any oscillations faster than that just because we're dependent on, I mean, it takes three rounds of protein transcription and degradation in order to do one oscillation. The other thing is, I mean, this is roughly of the same order. I mean, it's actually a little bit longer than the division time of these cells. So in order to complete one oscillation, you have to track the cells through a generation. And I mean, once they divide, each of these two cells is doing their own thing. And one of them might decide to oscillate a little bit faster. One of them might have a lag after the division. So the mother doesn't tell you very much about what the daughters are going to do. So you start out with a population. I mean, so we have these knobs at each of the repressor proteins. So you add in IPTG for a while just to keep, or actually, even better, so we use the C1 temperature-sensitive mutant. So you do this temperature-sensitive switch. So initially, this repressor doesn't work. And so the cells stay in, so you make a lot of the LacI, and you're just stuck in this state where you're making LacI. You've got no TET-R and no lambda C1 around. So suddenly you do this temperature switch, and all of the cells start oscillating. And because they were in the same state when you started, they all switched at the same time. Everyone starts their oscillation at the same time. So they start up, the entire population, all of the cells that you look at, are pretty similar. The problem is, so some of them start oscillating with that period, some of them oscillate a little bit faster, some of them oscillate a little bit slower, and by the time you look out here, the cells are completely unsynchronized. So, for instance, if you tried to do a population level measurement at this point, you get noise. Because some cells are at the high point of their oscillation, some are at the low point, and it's impossible to distinguish anything. So you can tell these apart by microscopy because you're following the same cell. So you know exactly what cell you're looking at, and you know, I mean, you took a picture of that same cell 5 minutes ago, 10 minutes ago, and so you can track their oscillations. So one of sort of the thing, so everyone uses this as an example of synthetic biology, is look at Michael Elowitz's repressilator. I mean, anytime somebody gives a talk about synthetic biology, there's a good chance that they'll bring this up. The sort of dirty little secret is it doesn't work very well. So if you saw the plots that Michael showed in his paper, it shows like two oscillations. That was very good data. That was unusually good data for this system. So pretty quickly, this oscillation stops working. And it just sort of gets stuck in one of the three states. And so you get oscillations for a while, and then it does that, or it blows up, or it just sort of flatlines. And it's not really interesting after that point. So there are a lot of proposals of ways to make better oscillators. For instance, there was a suggestion that you could take the oscillator design and connect it to this sender-receiver. So now you have the cells sending out a message of here's what. So we have these three states. You can either be high in tet R, high in MAC I, or high in C1. You could have the cell broadcast sort of, I'm in tet R state, and synchronize based on that. They're good, again, coming back to this question of experiments versus modeling, there are good models that show that this could work. No one's been able to do it experimentally, as far as I know. And there are other ideas. So there's actually a guy who's going to be coming here to give a talk next week about trying to build a better oscillator. But right now, we don't have a very good oscillator. This is the best that exists. But, I mean, the sort of take-home lesson here is you can get relatively complicated dynamics. I mean, an oscillation, biological oscillation, from just three proteins connected in series. And, I mean, today, cloning this would be a couple weeks' worth of work, and you have it. And in return, you get these pretty complicated dynamics. And any questions on the repressilator? OK, then that was what I wanted to cover today. So.